Welcome, everyone. My name is Samir Kakodkar. I'm a gastroenterologist and specialist in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Welcome to Against the Grain. Please do check out the rest of my podcasts, which can be found at the website samir3.podomatic.com. It can also be found on YouTube or Spotify by searching my first and last name. For those who are interested in contacting me regarding questions or for virtual appointments, my email is samir3@gmail.com. Please join the private Facebook group called Against the Grain for ongoing discussions about these podcasts. This podcast is not meant to be medical advice or a substitute for medical care. This is a discussion to encourage further research into this topic. There's a new once-a-day oral medication for ulcerative colitis called Zeposia. Another name for it is ozanimod. This podcast is a full breakdown of this medication, and I'll go over the clinical trial called the True North Study that led to the FDA approval. This study was funded by Bristol Myers Squibb, and I want to make it clear that I am not. As a policy, I don't accept money from any pharmaceutical companies. It may be difficult to find a doctor speaking about this drug elsewhere who does not have some kind of conflict of interest, which means accepting funding from either Bristol Myers Squibb itself or a competing pharma company. So this is not a commercial for this medication. This is, you know, a podcast regarding my opinions and my analysis of the literature after reviewing it. Before we get into the study, I wanted to talk about a concept called the therapeutic ceiling of medications in ulcerative colitis. So specifically with respect to remission for induction. So induction means once a medicine is started and after, you know, several weeks, they decide if the medicine is working or not according to very strict criteria. And that remission rate for induction cannot surpass 20 to 30% at the upper limit so far with the medications we have available. And just to go into the specifics, what is the remission rate for induction for all of the other medicines that are FDA approved for ulcerative colitis? For Remicade, it's about 33 to 39%. For Humira, it's 16.5% of patients. Simponi, 17.8%. Entyvio, 16.9%. Stelara, 15.5%. Xeljanz, 16.6 to 18.5%. And Zeposia, which is what we're going to be talking about today, is 18.4%. So, you know, they are roughly similar. It seems like, you know, Remicade has a little bit of a higher, induction remission rate. But for the most part, we're talking about a 20 to 30% upper limit here. And so this is one of the problems with new medicines that are continuously coming out for this condition, is that we can't break this ceiling, this therapeutic ceiling of roughly 20 to 30%, which is unfortunate. But it is good that we have multiple options, and there are still plenty of people who respond. So because of this therapeutic ceiling, the next frontier of using these medications seems to be combining them, using medications with different mechanisms of action to see if the combination leads to better outcomes. And we already do that with medicines like Remicade and azathioprine, but for example, using a medication like Stelara combined with Remicade to see if that may lead to a better outcome. There's some preliminary data that some of these combinations may be more effective, but the jury's still out regarding if this is actually going to be done and regarding the safety profile of doing so. The study I'm going to be reviewing today is called Ozanimod as Induction and Maintenance Therapy for Ulcerative Colitis. I will put a link to the study in the show notes. Zeposia is a sphingosine 1-phosphate receptor modulator. So before we can understand how this medication works, we need to know some immunology. S1P itself is a signaling molecule that's put out by other cell types, like endothelial cells or platelets, at sites of inflammation. Now, immune cells called lymphocytes can actually sense these S1P molecules, and they follow that gradient of less to more, so that they can travel to the sites of inflammation by sensing this gradient of S1P molecules. You can think of Zeposia as almost like a decoy for these S1P signaling molecules. Zeposia actually binds to these S1P receptors on lymphocytes, and instead of telling that lymphocyte to travel to the site of inflammation, it actually leads to internalization. These receptors actually go within the lymphocyte and are ubiquinated, which means they're kind of tagged to be destroyed within the cell. So it helps to get rid of these receptors so that the lymphocytes don't sense the real S1P molecules and go to the inflammation. And as a result, they almost get trapped within the lymph nodes, so they don't go out to the rest of the tissues that may be inflamed. And in the context of IBD and ulcerative colitis, it's going to be the colon. I have another analogy to help conceptualize how Zeposia works. So you've heard of the saying, follow the cookie crumbs. Follow the cookie crumbs to get to where, to solve the mystery, to get the stash of cookies, whatever it may be. So the S1P signaling molecules that help lymphocytes get to the site of inflammation, I think of those as cookie crumbs. And what do you do to sense cookie crumbs in real life? You smell them, you can see them, so you can follow them. And that's what the lymphocytes do to follow that gradient to get where they want to go. Zeposia almost acts like somebody punching you in the face so that you can't see or smell these signaling molecules. And that's what it's doing, right? It's binding to these S1P receptors, internalizing them and destroying them. So the lymphocytes can't sense that gradient, can't follow those cookie crumbs to the inflammation. Zeposia is not the first medication within this class. S1P receptor modulators have been approved for multiple sclerosis since 2010. And in 2020, this specific one, Zeposia, was approved for adults with relapsing forms of multiple sclerosis. Zeposia is thought to be one of the safer medications within this class. In 2021, Zeposia became the first and only S1P receptor modulator to be FDA approved for the treatment of adults with moderately to severe ulcerative colitis. So it's for adults, it's not for children as of right now, and it's also not for Crohn's disease. There were some adverse events that were known to occur with ozanimod in previous clinical trials on multiple sclerosis that they kept a close eye on in this trial. This included elevated liver enzymes on blood work, bradycardia, which means a slowed heart rate, serious or opportunistic infections, and macular edema, which is a specific type of eye condition. The True North study was a 52-week phase 3 trial evaluating ozanimod as induction and maintenance therapy in moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. This was the highest quality type of study you can do in studying a medication. This was a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial, and this was conducted in 285 sites in 30 countries. What kind of patients were included in the trial? So this is called the inclusion criteria. So they only included adults, patients aged 18 to 75. Women of childbearing age needed to use contraception or be abstinent during the trial, so there were no pregnant patients included. And they needed to have moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. So what that means is, they have this kind of grading score called a Mayo score, which includes certain clinical parameters as well as endoscopic parameters. So the Mayo score had to be 6 to 12, an endoscopy subscore of 2 or higher, rectal bleeding subscore of 1 or higher, and stool frequency subscore of 1 or higher. And if you're interested to look into what the Mayo score is and what actually technically what moderate to severe ulcerative colitis is, I encourage you to do that. You can just Google what Mayo score is. This trial did exclude patients with ulcerative proctitis, meaning having only up to 15 centimeters of inflammation from the anal verge. The reason for that is it's difficult to capture the disease activity according to the measures that they have, including the Mayo score, when you have that limited of disease extent. And this is actually not uncommon. Most of the studies that have been done in ulcerative colitis with other medications also excluded ulcerative proctitis for this very reason. Could patients be taking other medications before enrolling into this study? Yes, they could. Certain medicines, particularly oral mesalamine or steroids, like less than 20 milligrams of prednisone or budesonide, or they could be taking both for at least 2 weeks prior to screening colonoscopy. So they had to be on it for some time and still have moderate to severe ulcerative colitis before getting into the trial. And during the induction period, they had to continue those stable doses, and then the dose had to be tapered once in the maintenance phase. Patients also had to have a documented prior infection with varicella zoster or chickenpox, or have the serology for that, an IgG level to document that they've had the infection before, or completed the vaccine series within 30 days of entry. And as we'll talk about a little bit later, this is what is suggested if you actually are going to start this medication. So what about the exclusion criteria? So these were categories of patients that they excluded. And it's important to, in your mind, think, do you fit within any of these categories? Because if you do, you're not technically part of the study population. So if patients had severe extensive colitis, meaning they were likely to need a colectomy in 12 weeks. So these are patients who are very sick, probably failed multiple medications, maybe not responding to steroids. They weren't part of the study population. Also, no response to induction with two prior biologics approved for ulcerative colitis. So are you somebody that's not responded to Remicade and Entyvio? Then you wouldn't be allowed to be in this trial. And I do think this is probably some of the tricks the pharma companies try to do now as far as trying to boost the results of these trials, is try to select a patient population that's more likely to respond to their drug. So this is one of the things that they've done, is, you know, they don't want to have patients enrolled who've failed every medication, because that's a patient that's probably not going to respond and going to affect their results. What about cardiac conditions? So if you've had a recent heart attack in the last 6 months, or you've had angina, unstable angina, which means, you know, chest pain that is attributed to coronary artery disease, if you've had a stroke or a TIA, which is a mini stroke, decompensated heart failure requiring hospitalization, class 3 or 4 heart failure, which is severe heart failure, sick sinus syndrome, which is a conduction problem in the heart, and severe untreated sleep apnea. Also, prolonged QTC, which is a measurement they do on EKGs to see if you're predisposed to certain arrhythmias, and they define that as greater than 450 for males and 470 for females, or other risk factors for having a prolonged QTC. Having a resting heart rate of less than 55, having type 1 diabetes and uncontrolled type 2 diabetes, or with retinopathy or nephropathy, history of uveitis or macular edema, and history of cancer. So all of those were excluded from this trial. There were also some lab exclusion criteria. If you had some renal insufficiency, elevated liver enzymes, if you were significantly anemic, hemoglobin less than 8, any EKG abnormalities, and a platelet count less than 100,000, you're excluded. So now going on to the trial design, think of this study in two parts. The first part is going over induction, which is 10 weeks, the first 10 weeks of therapy. And then the subsequent part of the study is the maintenance phase, which they take responders to whatever therapy somebody was randomized to, and then they randomize them again and see how they do over a subsequent 42 weeks. The exception to that is patients who started on placebo and responded to placebo were not randomized subsequently. They were just continued on placebo in the maintenance phase. Specifically looking at the induction part of the trial, there were two cohorts or two groups of patients. Cohort 1 was the one that was randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive either ozanimod or a matched placebo. This was double-blind study, so the people who were conducting the study didn't know who was getting placebo or the drug, and same thing with the patients enrolled in the study. They didn't know if they were getting the placebo or the actual medication. They wanted to cap the amount of patients who had received anti-TNF biologics in the past, such as Humira or Remicade, up to a max of 30%. So once they had enrolled that amount of patients in cohort one, once they had had 30% of their group had had those medications in the past, they subsequently enrolled patients in another cohort, cohort two, so that they didn't have too many patients who had experienced those medications in the past in cohort one, because it's known that patients who have been on Remicade or Humira in the past are less likely to respond to subsequent medications, and they didn't want to have a patient population enrolling in this trial that was known to be particularly refractory. So what is this second group or cohort two? It was actually an open label study. So again, these people that they had, these extra patients who may not fit into cohort one because they had too many people there who had already been on anti-TNF medicines, or even additional patients who did not have anti-TNF in the past, but the quota for cohort one had already been reached, they were enrolled in this second group called cohort two. And the purpose of this second group is, I mean, they gave everybody ozanimod. There was no placebo. They did cap the amount of people in cohort two who had experienced anti-TNF biologic medicines in the past to a max of 50%. And so they had this additional group of people who were getting ozanimod so that in the maintenance phase, after 10 weeks, when we have the second phase of the trial, they had more people to enroll in that second phase, more responders. Because in that second phase, again, they only take people who responded to the medicine. Everyone else who did not respond is not eligible to go on to the second phase of the trial. Zeposia is started with a 7-day dose escalation pack. So if you're a patient who actually were to start this, you don't just start with the 0.92 milligram dose. You get a starter pack where, you know, day 1 to 4, you're on 0.23 milligrams per day. Then days 5 to 7, you're on 0.46 milligrams per day. And then after that, it's 0.92 milligrams. And the reason they do this is because they think slowly increasing the dose over time is to minimize the risk of bradycardia or a slow heart rate. And so when they do this protocol, they have a very low rate of that actually happening. To minimize bias in the study, the assessments were done by one central reader. So there was pretty much one person who was blinded with respect to if a patient was on Zeposia or placebo. And that person looked at endoscopic videos of endoscopic procedures and also pathologists looking at the biopsies. And rectal bleeding and stool frequency were reported by the patients themselves in a diary. The primary outcome measure for this study is clinical remission at week 10 and week 52. Remember what I said previously, that this study has two parts. The first part is the induction phase, and then responders go on to the maintenance phase. So the week 10 clinical remission is at the end of that induction period, and then at week 52, it's the end of that maintenance phase for the responders. So how do you define clinical remission? And a lot of people ask this question just in clinical practice. Patients wonder, am I in remission? So at least according to the clinical trials in ulcerative colitis, this is the definition. It's based on the Mayo score. So the Mayo score is this scoring system that has four components that have different point values. So there's stool frequency, which has a score from 0 to 3, rectal bleeding, which has a score from 0 to 3, findings on endoscopy, also a score from 0 to 3, and this physician global assessment, which is somewhat subjective, but that also has a score from 0 to 3. So clinical remission is defined by a rectal bleeding subscore of 0, which means no blood is seen, Stool frequency subscore of 1 or less with a decrease of at least 1 point from baseline. So stool frequency subscore of 1 is 1 to 2 bowel movements more than normal, and 0 is normal number of stools for this patient. And endoscopy subscore should be 1 or less without friability. In clinical practice, we often use this Mayo score, and you may be seeing this on your colonoscopy reports. So a Mayo score of 1 means mild disease or erythema or redness, decreased vascular pattern, or mild friability. But again, in this clinical trial, they said that there cannot be any friability, which this is, I believe, one of the first trials to actually require that, because they really want to make sure there's not clinically important inflammation going on. And a subscore of 0 is normal. A secondary outcome they looked at was clinical response at week 10. So this is not as stringent of criteria as remission, but response was actually what they looked at in order to make that decision if they can go on to the second part of the study in the maintenance phase, because they only took responders. So what's the definition of clinical response? Was a reduction in the total Mayo score of greater than or equal to 3, and greater than or equal to 30% reduction from baseline, or in 3-component Mayo score of greater than or equal to 2 points, and greater than or equal to a 35% reduction from baseline, and reduction in rectal bleeding subscore of greater than or equal to 1, or absolute rectal bleeding subscore of less than or equal to 1. The details of this are not important, but it's basically responding, but it's not as strict criteria compared to clinical remission as they defined it. So those patients who were deemed clinical responders at week 10 were randomized in a 1-to-1 ratio to receive either Zeposia or placebo through week 52. So even those patients who responded to Zeposia could potentially subsequently get placebo in the maintenance phase. So those responders who were receiving placebo at the end of induction, which there were some people like that who actually got the equivalent of a sugar pill or nothing and still responded somehow. And at the end of induction, they continued to receive placebo in the maintenance phase. Other week 10 secondary outcome measures were endoscopic improvement, which they defined as a Mayo score of less than or equal to 1 without friability, and then mucosal healing, which is endoscopic improvement with histologic remission, meaning the biopsies actually look like there isn't significant inflammation going on, particularly absence of neutrophils. The week 52 secondary outcome measures, besides clinical remission, were clinical response, endoscopic improvement, maintenance of clinical remission, steroid-free remission, meaning being in remission with no steroid use for greater than or equal to 12 weeks, mucosal healing, and durable clinical remission, which means remission at week 10 and at week 52. So table 1 in any randomized controlled trial is an important table to look at because it lists out all the demographic and clinical characteristics amongst the groups that are enrolled in the study. So this is this table looked at cohort 1, which has two groups of patients in cohort 1, right? It has the Zeposia group and the placebo group, and then cohort 2, which is the kind of open label group that everyone received Zeposia. And just to summarize, pretty much all the clinical characteristics and demographics are roughly equally distributed amongst the groups. There isn't one group, for example, that has much more severe patients compared to another group. It seems to be all equally distributed. And that's the whole function of doing a randomized controlled trial, is to make sure the groups have equal distribution of these clinical characteristics, of these demographic characteristics that may have an effect on the outcome measures, and also things that we don't even think of, unmeasured confounders that we may not preemptively know about or that could affect results are also, you know, the randomization procedure helps to equally distribute it amongst the groups that are getting placebo versus drug so they don't affect ultimately the results. Notably, we spoke previously about patients who have received anti-TNF medicines like Remicade, Humira, Simponi, that those types of patients tend to be more refractory if they haven't responded to those medicines to subsequent medications, potentially like Zeposia. So what was the breakdown in this study? As we know, in cohort 1, it was capped at 30%, and that's what it was. And then in cohort 2, it was capped at 50%, but it was actually 43% of those patients had experienced anti-TNF in the past. So let's get to the results, starting with week 10, the induction period. At the end of 10 weeks, 18.4% of patients on Zeposia were in remission, compared to 6% in the placebo group. So it's a threefold increased rate of remission with Zeposia. So 18.4% may sound like a pretty low number, and I suppose it is. I mean, taking all comers and only 18.4% of them are in remission at the end of 10 weeks. But it is comparable, and you could say unfortunately, to a lot of the other medications that are out there, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, this therapeutic ceiling. What about the other secondary outcome measures at week 10? So for clinical response, it was 47.8% in the Zeposia group versus 25.9% in the placebo group. This was also statistically significant. Endoscopic improvement, which is, again, a Mayo score of 1 or 0 without friability, and that was 27.3% in the Zeposia group versus 11.6% in the placebo group. This was also statistically significant. And mucosal healing, which means endoscopic improvement with also, you know, not much inflammation in the biopsies, including absence of neutrophils, and that was 12.6% in the Zeposia group versus 3.7% in the placebo group, also statistically significant. Going over the maintenance period results, so taking those responders at the end of week 10 and randomizing them to placebo or Zeposia, what were the results at week 52? So pretty much everything I'm going to mention right now was statistically significant, all the outcome measures, in favor of Zeposia over placebo. And so the specific percentages were clinical remission was 37% in Zeposia versus 18.5% in placebo. Clinical response was 60% in Zeposia versus 41% in placebo. Endoscopic improvement was 45.7% versus 26.4% in placebo. Maintenance of remission, 52% in Zeposia, 29% in placebo. Steroid-free remission was 31.7% in Zeposia versus 16.7% in placebo. Mucosal healing was 29.6% in Zeposia and 14.1% in placebo. And durable remission was 17.8% versus 9.7% in placebo. So just for some context, I wanted to just cite the numbers from the trials from Stelara and Entyvio. So looking at Stelara first of all, 50% of that patient population had at least one anti-TNF medicine in the past, which would be higher than in this trial. And, you know, regardless of prior Entyvio use in this group, the week 6 clinical response was 61.8% compared to what we just talked about with Zeposia. The week 10 clinical response in Zeposia was 47.8%. And clinical remission at week 6 was 15.5%. And clinical remission in Zeposia, just to remind you, is 18.4%. Week 44 clinical remission in Stelara was 43.8%. And in Zeposia, clinical remission at week 52 is 37%. Again, this is not a head-to-head trial, and you probably can't make many conclusions based on those numbers, but just to get some sense that I would say the numbers are roughly similar. Maybe the initial clinical response is a little bit higher in Stelara, but it's not a head-to-head trial. What about Entyvio? So this was the Gemini 1 study, and in that study, 40% of the patients had failed one or more anti-TNFs, which is a little bit higher than the 30% number in this Zeposia trial. The week 6 response rate for Entyvio was 47.1%. Again, to remind you, it's 47.8%, so pretty similar with Zeposia. And the remission rate at week 6 was 16.9%, and again, for Zeposia, it was 18.4% at week 10. The week 52 clinical remission for Entyvio was 41.8%, and in Zeposia, week 52 remission rate was 37%. So it's roughly similar. The numbers are roughly similar. So you can't really say there's a huge signal that one may be superior to another. But again, in order to really answer that question, if Zeposia is superior with regard to efficacy to either of these medicines, you'd have to do a randomized controlled trial looking at them head-to-head. You can't make conclusions just based on the numbers from the different trials. So looking at histologic remission by itself, they did give some graphs regarding the percentage of patients who were able to achieve that in the induction and maintenance period. So how did they define histologic remission? It's defined as absence of neutrophils in the epithelial crypts or lamina propria, and no increase in eosinophils, no crypt destruction, and no erosions, ulcerations, or granulation tissue on the biopsy slides. And if you want really a master class on the pathology of IBD, please listen to my podcast I did with Dr. Sriram Jagate on that whole topic. But it is an outcome measure that people are looking at more and more. It may be the case that if you get histologic remission, you may have more of a durable response and better outcomes. So when the induction period with Zeposia was 18.2% achieved that versus 7.4% in the placebo group. And then in the maintenance phase, 33.5% achieved that histologic remission versus 16.3% in the placebo group. One note I want to mention about cohort 2, which was the open label portion of the induction trial where everyone received ozanimod, there the outcome measures for that were pretty similar to the patients who got Zeposia in cohort 1 with respect to clinical remission, clinical response, endoscopic improvement, and mucosal healing. Pretty similar numbers. So that's important to know so that the cohort 2 is probably somewhat of an accurate reflection of the population that was randomized, that was actually randomized in the cohort 1 of the induction phase of the trial, so that it's probably valid that they were included, the responders were included in the maintenance phase of the trial. They do have a graph in the supplement of the article, actually figure S4, which is a graph showing time to disease relapse in the maintenance period. So of these patients who are responders who are randomized to either Zeposia or placebo, it shows you the proportion of patients that did not relapse over time, over the course of the subsequent 44 weeks. And you can see that there is a clear drop-off as far as people staying in remission amongst the people on placebo. You can see it as soon as week 8. There's a drop-off in people losing response who are on placebo. And there is a little bit of a drop-off of patients on Zeposia over time, but not much. It's most people seem to be maintaining that remission over time if they've responded initially. They did do a sensitivity analysis looking at different variables and adjusting them to see if it had an effect on the outcome measures. And one of the variables that is very important to look at is this prior use of anti-TNF medicines. So they didn't see a significant difference in the treatment effect based on if somebody had been on those medicines or not. So that is a good sign that just because you've failed Humira, Remicade in the past, it doesn't necessarily mean you're less likely to respond to this. And we don't often see that with newer medications coming out. I do find that sometimes people make assumptions about medications based on the mode of delivery, if a medicine's an oral or an injection or an infusion. And sometimes patients assume that if it's an injection or an infusion, it's somehow stronger or works quicker or has a worse side effect profile, which often is not the case. I mean, if you look at medicines like Stelara or Entyvio, in my experience, their side effect profile is quite safe, safer than a lot of the other oral medicines, like, for example, azathioprine or Xeljanz. Really compared to placebo, there isn't much with either of these medicines that has been found. Of course, there are rare things, case reports of very rare things with both of those medicines, but for the most part, they're, I consider those two to be really the safest ones. So, you know, one thing that you may assume is that Zeposia, since this is an oral medicine, it probably doesn't work very quickly. But according to the data in this trial, that may not be the case. There's a figure S6 in the supplemental appendix, which shows the change from baseline over time in rectal bleeding score during the induction phase. And you can see a separation from placebo with Zeposia as soon as even week 2, or definitely by week 4, there's a clear separation in rectal bleeding. We know that rectal bleeding is often the first thing to improve when starting any treatment for ulcerative colitis, and usual bowel frequently follows that, but rectal bleeding improves first. So we're seeing, you know, relatively quick results here. And what about figure S7? If you're looking at the article, there's another similar graph here showing the change from baseline over time in stool frequency score during the induction phase. And you can see that there is more of a lag from rectal bleeding, but as soon as week 5 or 6, you see some separation there. Again, this is an oral medicine. Seems, according to this data, that it, for some people, it can work quickly, but there are other medicines like Entyvio and even Stelara, and in my experience, in the context of using them in ulcerative colitis, can take longer. With Entyvio, sometimes at least 10 weeks to notice anything, but it can take even 3 to 4 months, sometimes up to 6 months with both of those medicines, as long as there's some improvement, we continue kind of monitoring. But this seems to have better data with respect to working quicker. They did keep track of fecal calprotectin levels at week 10 and week 52, and it's sufficient to say that they did significantly decrease with the Zeposia group compared to the placebo groups at both week 10 and week 52. Now let's talk about the side effects or safety events. So regarding adverse events or serious adverse events related to ozanimod or placebo and adverse events leading to discontinuation of the regimen, they were roughly similar amongst all of the groups. There wasn't a signal that Zeposia was particularly associated with a higher discontinuation rate related to adverse events. It doesn't seem like Zeposia is associated with necessarily a large signal of having serious infections associated with it when compared to placebo. You know, perhaps there may be a little bit of an increased risk of, you know, upper respiratory infections or nasopharyngitis, but really hardly above the placebo rate, maybe a slightly above that. And there are a few herpes zoster infections, just a very few, like two cases in the ozanimod or Zeposia group versus zero in the placebo group in cohort 1, and just one in the cohort 2 group. And this is out of hundreds of patients. So what about cancer? Everyone worries about cancer. And actually, for the induction period in the cohort 1 Zeposia group, there were no cancers detected. In cohort 2, there was only one basal cell carcinoma, a type of skin cancer, noted in cohort 2 Zeposia group. But that's out of, you know, 367 patients. That may just be coincidence. Who knows? As far as the maintenance period, there was a colon cancer, one case of a colon cancer in the placebo group in the maintenance period, and one case of basal cell carcinoma, again, the type of skin cancer, that was in the Zeposia group in the maintenance phase. There was one rectal cancer in the Zeposia group and one breast cancer in the placebo group. So, I mean, very small numbers. You know, it's probably not related to the medication. We can't say for sure. Again, remember, regarding these colon cancers, ulcerative colitis is a risk factor for colon cancer itself, and that's probably a higher risk of colon cancer is untreated ulcerative colitis rather than a medication that's trying to help heal it up. They did report on the adverse events of special interest, those side effects known to occur with this class of medication based on other trials. That included bradycardia, hypertension, hypertensive crisis, and macular edema. In the induction period, none of the patients receiving placebo had any of these side effects, but there were some patients who were getting Zeposia who did get these issues, but still relatively small numbers. I would say high blood pressure, you know, it was 6 in cohort 1 and 7 in cohort 2, again, out of hundreds of patients. Hypertensive crisis, meaning ending up in the hospital because of blood pressure very high. There was one patient like that in cohort 1. And I saw recently there was a case report published of a patient who ended up having hypertensive crisis, very high blood pressure. Macular edema, only one patient in the Zeposia group in the cohort 1 and one in cohort 2 developed that. In the maintenance period, similar numbers. We did see some in the placebo group develop hypertension and hypertensive crisis, and similar numbers in the Zeposia group who developed those as well. There was also definitely a higher rate of patients who developed elevated liver enzymes on blood work, as well as a decreased lymphocyte count. But overall, the absolute numbers were relatively low, but still higher than placebo. So I did comb through the package insert for this medication to see kind of all the warnings associated with it, just so you're aware of everything that's there. And I think if you're going to start a medicine like this, you should know this information. This is not to frighten you or scare you about it, because most of these warnings actually probably are not relevant to the medication. There are more things that they're required to say because of other medicines that are within the same class that have been associated with these kind of side effects or precautions. But you should still nonetheless know this information, so I'll go over what I thought was relevant. So they do say in the package insert that it is a contraindication to use this medicine if you've had any of the following in the last 6 months: a heart attack, unstable angina, stroke, TIA, which is a mini stroke, or transient ischemic attack, decompensated heart failure requiring hospitalization, class 3 or 4 heart failure, Mobitz type 2 or type 3 heart block, sick sinus syndrome, sinoatrial block unless there is a functioning pacemaker. So that's technically a contraindication, but it doesn't seem like it's an absolute contraindication. I think if you have any of these things, you definitely would have to be cleared by your cardiologist. You'd have to see your heart doctor and make sure they're okay with you still taking the medicine in this context. But I think there's plenty of other medications available now, so Zeposia is probably not going to be the best choice if you have other options, if you have any of these other things going on. Severe untreated sleep apnea is also a contraindication. So I do think there's a lot of sleep apnea out there that has not been diagnosed. This is just a public service announcement. If you are having a lot of snoring, or other family members have noticed you snore a lot and you have a lot of daytime sleepiness, maybe you have high blood pressure, you should think about getting screened for sleep apnea, because that can really improve your health outcomes if you get that treated. But if you have untreated sleep apnea, you're not supposed to be on ozanimod. You should also not take Zeposia if you're already on a medication class called monoamine oxidase inhibitors. These are medications that are relatively uncommon, but sometimes used for depression or Parkinson's disease. There could be an interaction there that you'd have to avoid. What about the infections that are listed in the package insert that can be associated with these type of medications? Herpes zoster has been reported, herpes simplex virus encephalitis, an infection in the brain due to herpes simplex, or varicella zoster meningitis has also been reported, not from Zeposia, but from medications within the similar class. Cryptococcal meningitis has been reported, again, not with Zeposia, but a medication within the same S1P modulator medication class. And, you know, that's a type of fungal meningitis, and that can be fatal. But, again, that's extremely rare and not actually seen with this particular medication, but a similar one. Progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, which is a type of brain infection usually caused by a virus called the John Cunningham virus that can be fatal as well. This has been reported in other S1P modulator medicines, but not Zeposia. So it is in the package insert. It can decrease heart rate and lead to conduction delays, like we already talked about. Elevation of liver enzymes can occur. Based on animal studies, Zeposia may cause fetal harm. So that's why they excluded pregnant patients, and also women of childbearing age were told to use contraception. So they say you should avoid using this during pregnancy, and you really preferably should stop this 3 months prior to conception if you're planning pregnancy. What you do in that time period, if you're doing well on Zeposia, is a little bit complicated, but sometimes it's just stopping and monitoring. So high blood pressure. So this can occur by itself or in association with eating foods that have a large amount of tyramine. Some examples of foods that may be high in tyramine include strong or aged cheeses, cured meats, smoked or processed meats, pickled or fermented foods such as sauerkraut or kimchi, sauces such as soy sauce, shrimp sauce, fish sauce, miso and teriyaki sauce, soybeans, meat tenderizers, yeast extract, spreads, certain alcoholic beverages such as beer. So you can imagine how this may be a complicated issue if you're already following a dietary protocol for ulcerative colitis that could include some of these things. Zeposia may also cause a decline in pulmonary function. There's not many details of how or why that occurs, but it's something to keep an eye on. Macular edema. And that's this eye condition that we see rarely with this medication. And risk factors for that are having uveitis, which can go along with IBD as an extraintestinal manifestation, or diabetes. So you should see an ophthalmologist before starting the medicine if that's really your only option. And posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome has been seen in other S1P modulators. It's also of note been seen with Stelara in case reports, but it's usually presents with an unexpected psychological or neurological symptom, including headache. It's usually reversible, but if it's not detected, it can evolve into even having a stroke or a bleed in the brain. So again, that's not been seen with Zeposia specifically, or it's more in medications that have a similar mode of action. The most common side effects of Zeposia in the ulcerative colitis population have been upper respiratory infections, elevated liver enzymes, and headache. I wanted to briefly speak about the elevated liver enzyme issue. So for the patients listening, liver enzymes are ALT, AST, ALK-FOS, total bilirubin. Those are the things in your complete metabolic panel that are called liver enzymes. And now, the overall proportion of patients who had an elevation in the liver enzymes over three times the upper limit of normal in the induction phase was 2.6% versus 0.5% in placebo, and in the maintenance phase it was 2.3% versus 0% in the placebo. As far as patients who had it above five times the upper limit of normal, it was 0.9% in Zeposia versus 0.5% in placebo, and 0.9% in Zeposia in the maintenance phase versus 0% in placebo. So there were really no patients who developed hepatic injury that would be consistent with Hy's Law, which generally means liver enzymes over three times the upper limit of normal and having jaundice, meaning the total bilirubin is high enough where it's causing your skin to look yellow. And those patients, if you do fulfill that criteria, can potentially go on to having liver failure about 10% of the time. So they didn't see anybody fulfill that criteria. So overall, only 0.4% of patients had to discontinue Zeposia due to liver enzyme issues. And a lot of times, the liver enzyme elevation was only transient. It was there. Then when they rechecked it, maybe 2 or 4 weeks later, it had significantly improved or actually resolved. So just having elevated liver enzymes doesn't mean you have to stop the medicine. It needs to be monitored and checked and followed up on. But potentially, if it continues to go up or you develop jaundice or something like that, it has to be stopped. So if you've made the decision to start Zeposia, what are the required tests before going forward with it? For all patients, they need blood work. They need a CBC with a lymphocyte count. And that has to be done within the last 6 months or after discontinuation of the prior ulcerative colitis therapy. And you need to get liver enzymes. You need to get an EKG to determine if there's any pre-existing conduction abnormalities. For select patients with a history of uveitis, macular edema, or diabetes, they need to see an ophthalmologist to get an exam. And if there's no documentation of a history of varicella zoster virus, chickenpox, or documentation of a full course of vaccination, you should test for VZV antibodies. If they're negative, then the patient needs a vaccine, a varicella vaccine, which should be given at least 1 month prior to starting Zeposia. So there you go. That's the breakdown of Zeposia for you. Hopefully that gives you all the information you need to know as much as the GI doctors know about this medication. It's still relatively new. Probably not a lot of people are on it right now. So I would consider it a good option for people who are particularly needle phobic, who are scared to get the infusions and the injections and are just more comfortable taking a pill every day. Maybe also these relatively young patients with ulcerative colitis who may be going to college, where it's hard to arrange to get these injections and infusions maybe on a college campus. I think the safety data is pretty good, especially with another open-label study that was published recently looking at 4 years of data of patients on Zeposia, and the safety data still looks pretty good on that. So it's up to you if you know what you want to do, but I think the safety profile is still not as good, in my opinion, compared to Entyvio or Stelara, but it's still decent and another tool in your toolbox to help get this disease under control.